It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
This is Trey. Thank you for joining us for another Thursday edition, also known as Question and hopefully Answer Day. I guess that depends in part on the questions. But one thing that is certain is we can't do it without Mary Langston. So I hope through the miracle of modern technology, she might be on the other end of this microphone. Are you there, Mary Langston?
I'm here. I made it. We've certainly missed Thursdays, and we're glad to be back.
We have missed it.
Hopefully you have some answers.
Almost exclusively my fault, hadn't it? I've had a few little setbacks here, there, and yonder, but I think what we ought to do in the future, because I'm not getting any younger, so I'm probably going to have more setbacks, is just let you pick the questions and provide the answers.
Oh, I don't know about that. We like your answers, so we'll keep to it. But summer's always busy, so I'm sure people understand and can relate to a lot going on.
Well, I hope they do, but it is one of my favorite moments because it is one of the few times during the week where you actually have to take the call. So,
yeah, I like text messages. That's for sure.
Yeah, well, we're both texters, but it is great to hear your voice, and we shall see what is on the minds of some of the good people that that listen to us from time to time.
That sounds great. Well, we appreciate y'all for sending questions our way each week and for tuning in. We'll start with a legal question from John in Tennessee. He writes, with so much misinformation and disinformation out there, especially when it comes to politics, where does one find actual factual information? Are there any sources that you can recommend? So they kind of want to know it from your legal perspective. You know, with that actual factual information part.
Well, John, that is a great question. It's a vexing question. It's a question that's on the minds of many of your fellow citizens, because I get that question from time to time. And it actually is heartening to get the question, because it tells me that people still care about the truth and they care about the facts. So I'm actually glad you phrased the question the way you did, John. There's a difference in how we receive inaccurate information. The result is the same for sure, but the process does matter. Sometimes people inadvertently give us wrong information. I mean, I'll use my wife, for example. There's not a chance in the world, I don't think, that my wife is ever going to like lie. I don't think she's got it in her. But that doesn't mean she can't be mistaken. So sometimes we get, and again, I'm not minimizing the fact that the result is the same. She tells me it's not raining outside, and it's raining outside, I'm going to get wet. But there is a difference, I think, in whether it's inadvertent, whether it's a simple mistake, whether people are biased. That's something I focus a lot on, is bias, interest in the outcome, a reason to be selective in the facts that are shared, because some people select some facts and ignore the others. Yeah, you're going to love this movie. I mean, the last 30 seconds is fantastic. Okay, great. But the first 3 hours are dreadful. I mean, it's torture. So don't pick some facts that suit your, I guess people think that's what's done in the courtroom. And I get, because sometimes that's what's done on television. But if you want to be really successful in the courtroom, you have to be the one to let the jury know all of the facts. You just have to be persuasive and convincing in how you communicate to them which facts are most important. So there are a lot of ways to get the wrong information. The best way to get the right information, the right information, is to find a trusted source, whether it's a reporter or a columnist or a host who cares about giving you the facts, as many of them as he or she can find. and then believes in you enough and trusts you enough to make up your own mind. But you also, even then, have to be critical. And I don't mean critical in the normal sense of the word. I mean critical as in a non-negative way, in mm-hmm. how you receive that information. Not cynical or skeptical like I am, but critical. By asking, let's start with this. How do you know that? I mean, Mary Langston, you and I have been around each other a long time. Thank mm-hmm. God I have not worn off on you yet. But you know that is always what I'm going to ask. I mean, you are so, you and Terry are like twins. Y'all don't believe that people are like bad or whatever, like mislead you, and you're mm-hmm. trusting. And I'm sitting there saying, well, how do y'all know that? I mean, you tell me the, you know, Chick-fil-A is, you know, to the left in New York City, because Lord knows I can't read those navigation devices. I mean, the first thing goes to my mind is, okay, I mean, how do you know that? I mean, my first instinct is not to trust. It is to ask, how do you know that? So another thing to ask is, what else is there? I know that you were telling me what's there. What do you not know? Where are your blind spots?
Mm.
I mean, if you watched a car wreck, but turned your head for a second to get the phone to call 911, what did you miss? You don't know what you missed. So are you candid enough with me to say, nah, not that I saw the whole thing. I saw everything except the 3 seconds where I turned my head to grab my phone to call 911. That makes you so much more credible.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you not know but wish you did? What do you know but you're still not telling me? What are you being selective about? I think you got to choose to read multiple sources and find the truth somewhere in the middle. And you do that by cross-examining what you read and hear. And you don't need to be a lawyer to do it. When you read a story this evening or you hear something on the news about really fill in the blank, any issue, I want you to ask, who did the reporter interview? Reporters don't go talk to all the, I mean, when they're writing a story on Congress, they don't go talk to every member of Congress. They find three or four. Okay, who? Are your sources anonymous? That is really important to me. Because if it's an anonymous source, how in the world do I know whether that source knows anything about what he or she's talking about? How do I know it's not an arch enemy? How do I know that source is not completely biased? I need to know the source. And by the way, there's a reason we don't have anonymous sources in the courtroom. They have them all the time in the media. You know, a source close to the president, a source with knowledge. I'm not like trying to get people hurt. I don't want to get people hurt. And if you don't want to use the name, don't use the name. But don't expect me to believe an anonymous source if I can't judge the credibility of that source. And then the other thing you got to ask yourself, John, is this publication historically right-leaning or left-leaning? All of that. I mean, there is no source for the truth. I mean, I think Terry and Mary Langston would say, that's the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And then even I would say, but yes, but there are also, I mean, there are two creation stories in the Bible. And there are like two different accounts of how Judas Iscariot died in the Bible. So you will leave the Bible out of it. We'll go with everything else. Just read it with a questioning spirit. And I think you will find yourself closer to the truth.
Well, thank you so much, Trey. And thank you, John, for that question. Our next question is from Karen in New Hampshire. She writes, do states permit a candidate to run for the House, Senate, or statewide office and president simultaneously?
Most states do not allow that, Karen, for the obvious reason that you cannot hold more than one office. There are very strict dual office holding prohibitions. Clearly, you can't be the senator and a House member at the same time. You may very well be able to run for president in another office at the same time, and not to get like too down deep in the weeds, there's a difference between whether or not you're running for president or whether or not you're running for vice president. I think the rules are actually, cause, you know, you don't like technically run for vice president. Somebody picks you to be the vice president. Mm. You don't like fill out a bunch of forms and apply for that job. So I would be really, really confident in saying, although I'm going to encourage people to do what I just got through telling them to do, which is look behind me and make sure I'm right. I'm pretty confident you cannot run for all of the four offices you mentioned at the same time, for pretty obvious reasons. I would check the states because they have different prohibitions. Some states may allow you to run for more things simultaneously than others. They may have rationale. I mean, obviously, states have different residency requirements. You can't change the requirements in the Constitution. Those are set. But you make an add to it. I mean, some states, this is way, way, way before your lifetime, Mary Langston, because it was barely in mine. Mm-hmm. We had a gubernatorial candidate in South Carolina that absolutely was going to win. Absolutely was going to win. But he had not been a citizen of the state quite long enough. And they nominated him anyway. And he was taken off the ballot. So they replaced him at the last minute. But that led to the first Republican governor in the state of South Carolina, I believe, since Reconstruction, which was Governor Dr. Jim Edwards. Mm. And the reason he won is because a very, very talented politician did not meet the state's residency requirement. So check the states. I feel pretty safe in saying there ain't a chance in the world you can run for the House, the Senate, Attorney General, and President at the same time. But different states will allow you to do different things. And again, I can't imagine any less compelling argument to the voters than I really want to be your senator, but I'm hedging my bets and I'm also running for clerk of court just in case. To me, that is not a great political argument, but what do I know?
That would be a lot of control for sure.
It also would be like hard to answer if you're, I can't say that.
Okay.
You know how cynical I am. You know how many politicians said, God told me to run for this?
Well, according to you, there are several.
Well, not just me. There are several. And I just cannot imagine that God cannot make up his mind which office he wants you to run for. But then somebody out there is going to say, well, he wants me to run for all of them. So who am I to know? What do I know?
Well, thank you so much for answering that question. And thank you, Karen, for it. We're going to hold it right there. Be back right after this.
The world of business moves fast. Stay on top of it with the Fox Business Rundown every Monday and Friday. Listen to the Fox Business Rundown starting May 20th at foxbusinesspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
Our next question is from Bobby in South Carolina. He writes, can you explain the required elements for a successful appeal of a criminal conviction? And do you think Alex Murdaugh could potentially win an appeal?
Well, I'm going to answer that question with what the appellate courts do not do first, and then I'll tell you what they do. They do not sit there and try to figure out whether the jury got it right or not. That is not what they do. Judge Quattlebaum, I have a very, very good friend of almost four decades that I was with this afternoon for a little while, who is an appellate judge in Richmond, Virginia, on the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. A fantastic person, fantastic judge. Being an appellate judge requires humility because their human nature wants to say, well, did I agree with this? Did I agree with what the jury did? I've got some friends that are on the South Carolina Supreme Court. They may ultimately, it's not a death penalty case, so it doesn't have to be them, but they may actually review the Alex Murdaugh appeal. Promise you, and they're not going to sit there and think, gosh, do I think the jury got it right? That is not what they do. You need a legal error, or in some instances, a factual insufficiency, which in fact is a legal error. So in other words, appellate courts do not weigh and balance the evidence. They don't weigh and balance the facts. They don't say, you know what, I really believed this witness more than the other. I don't know why the jury didn't see it that way. That is not what they do. Rarely, rarely will an appellate court ever tell a jury you got the facts wrong. And even then, what they'll say is there was no evidence to support that. They won't say you got the facts wrong, that you weighed them and balanced them in precisely or incorrectly, they'll say there is no evidence to support that. So that's, there's a difference between insufficient evidence and a dearth or absence of evidence. You're not going to find an appellate court that says, you know, you believe the wrong witnesses, you assign the wrong level of importance to the wrong testimony or piece of evidence. That is not what they do. They look at legal issues. So let's look at Murdoch. They mentioned Murdoch. Was it tried in the right venue? Was there a request to move it out of that county and into another county? And by the way, the state won and the defendant lost. So all the things the state was unhappy about, you can forget about that. Nobody cares about that anymore. They won. The defense lost. So what did the defense raise? Did they want to change venue? I can't remember. Probably not, but I can't remember. But that would be a legal issue. Were there errors in the selection of the jury? This is huge in death penalty cases. I mean, we spend days and days and days examining potential jurors in death penalty cases. Did the judge get it wrong when the judge said you are qualified to serve as a juror? That's a legal issue. Did the judge make the wrong evidentiary ruling? I mean, think back to the Murdoch case, all the objections and the fights and the quarrels about whether this evidence can, this witness can testify. Can this evidence come in? Is this evidence reliable? Those are legal. The threshold of whether the evidence comes in or not is a legal issue. What you do with that evidence is up to the jury. So did you watch Edom? You probably didn't watch much of the Murdoch trial, I wouldn't guess. Did you, Mary Langston?
I did watch a little bit of it.
Well, I am shocked. Color me shocked. But there was testimony about, well, I'll pick something that won't hurt your heart. Cell phone data, navigation. Mm-hmm. Okay. I am sure probably somebody objected to some of that evidence coming in. They may have done it outside the presence of the jury, but they did it. So Judge Newman has to decide whether or not the evidence comes in. But it's not his job to decide, okay, it comes in, now you should believe it. That's up to the jury. And the appellate court, they can review whether the evidence should have come in or not, but they cannot review whether the jury was smart or wise to rely on it. And then, not to get like super complicated, but let's assume, I mean, this trial lasted weeks and weeks and weeks. Imagine how many decisions Judge Newman had to make. It is hard to bat 100. It's hard. So let's assume some appellate court says, you know what, Judge Newman, tough call, but we think maybe this one should have gone the other way. Then you have to ask, does it matter? Was the guilt otherwise so overwhelming? Was the error harmless, is what we call it? Was it harmless error? So you don't get to appeal because you didn't like the result. You don't get to appeal because you wish you had done something differently. There has to be an error made, and that error has to be consequential, prejudicial. It has to, like, matter. So that is the way to judge the likelihood of success on appeal. And I actually bumped into both of Murdoch's lawyers at a judicial conference I was at a couple of weeks ago, and had a chance to catch up with them. I'm sure they're going to tell you there, you know, a lot of issues. They got a really good shot on appeal. I mean, everyone says that. And the reality is, I think Judge Cliff Newman did a really, really, really good job. Nothing like sticks out in my mind that if you get this wrong, it is the one category that you might possibly could argue would be all the financial testimony. You remember that kind of the motive testimony?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But there's an argument there that the defense opened the door to that.
Mm.
Remember?
Mm-hmm.
Why in the world would somebody who loved his wife and son this much ever do it? Maybe that's opening the door and allows the prosecutor to then say, well, we'll tell you why. And if they'd never said that, then the door would not have been opened and the judge may not have let it in. It is hard being a judge. It is, I mean, split second evidentiary decisions, and appellate courts know that. So it better be a serious consequential error of substance, or it is not going to be reversed. And I will buy you, Mary Langston. Let me think what you would want. You wouldn't want anything.
Nothing.
So this is an easy bet for me. I will buy you anything you want if the Alex Murdaugh conviction is overturned. Okay. That's the safest bet I've ever made.
Wow. All right. Well, thank you so much, Trey, for answering that question. I'm glad he asked you that question and not me. We'll move into our last question.
Knew all that?
No way. Thankfully, he asked you that. You've got a great legal mind and experience too. So, but our last question is sweet, and it's from Griffin in Kentucky. And he writes, I plan to go to law school after I get my undergraduate degree. What would be the biggest thing that you think I should focus on when I begin my undergraduate education?
You know what I'm going to do here, Mary Langston?
What are you going to do?
I've known you since you finished college. What do you think I would tell him? I mean, you've heard me answer this question a million times. What do I put the highest value on?
It could have changed. I think you would probably tell them to perhaps consider doing a focus, not doing a focus in political science, and maybe focusing on English, literacy, history, philosophy, those kind of areas, because if you can write and you're a good communicator, then it's helpful when you go to law school, or if you're a critical thinker, because I think sometimes you say that law school teaches you how to critical think and write. I assume you write a lot in law school, but that's kind of what I think you would point him in, but you go ahead.
Which is why you don't need me to do this podcast, because that is exactly what I would say. It is critical reasoning is what it is. So, Griffin, take courses that make you think, not make you memorize. Make you think. Mary Langston was an English major, so literature, psychology, philosophy, anything that makes you think critically, spot issues, first of all, you got to spot them. And then you have to analyze them, and you have to kind of weigh and balance and learn to prioritize information. What's critical? What's not critical? What's what we call a red herring, which is kind of fake important, but not really important. That is the best preparation for law school. And I don't know that everyone would tell you that, Griffin. I mean, other people might tell you other things, but having been and had two kids that went and am down there now teaching class, the ability to critically analyze issues and then communicate your position in a winsome, persuasive way is what it takes to be a good lawyer. And oh, by the way, it's also pretty good preparation for the rest of life.
Mm-hmm. Well, great advice, Trey, and best wishes to you, Griffin. And thank you all for sending us your questions again. And we've certainly missed it, and we're glad to be back at it.
You remember when I tried to talk you into going to law school?
I do. I am certainly not smart enough for law school, but I'm glad there are people that are.
True. That is not true. However, you may be too good of a person to go to law school. First of all, I've never heard you argue with anybody about anything. So I don't know. You'd have to be a transactional.
That would be hard.
You could be like an adoption lawyer, whatever job, like always made people happy. You would be good at that.
But, right. You're right. You got the argument.
But see there, you don't go to law school, but you critically analyze. I mean, you weigh and balance. And does this argument make more sense than that one? And how do I mean, you're going to be, you went back and got postgraduate degrees, communication, persuasion. That is, it is, you know, Judge Quattlebaum and I were laughing today. My first jury trial, I was objectively awful. I mean, that's not just, I mean, I was awful. And the judge I worked for, who also was presiding over that trial, called me in the back and said, you need to go to a bar. And I said, you know, Judge Anderson, I don't drink, so I'm not sure. I mean, I'm thinking about starting because I did really poorly in this trial, but I don't right now. And he goes, no, I don't care about that. You need to talk to real people, real everyday people. Find out how they think, what motivates them, what persuades them. And the ability to read issues and read people and be, you know, Mary Langston, you've seen it before. People get, they fall in love with their ideas and they're the last to realize nobody's being persuaded. The ability to like read a room, read a jury and say, okay, that's not working. This might, let me try this. That worked 2 weeks ago, but you know, different group, different age bracket, different, whatever. The ability to read people, read situations, prioritize information, and communicate it in a winsome way is the key to being a good lawyer. And lots of other things too, by the way.
I love that. Well, thank you so much, Trey, for explaining that to us. And hopefully that's helpful for you, Griffin. We appreciate you sending us that question. And I hope that y'all have a wonderful week. I guess we'll see you next Thursday. Is that right, Trey?
God willing. We will be here again next Thursday. I appreciate everybody sending questions. Really, legitimately, is one of the highlights of my week. I mean, I get a lot of questions from my wife, but she usually does not wait for me to answer them. She's kind enough to provide me both the question and the answer. So this is like a unique opportunity for me to get to actually answer the question.
Well, thank you for answering the questions, Trey.
All right. Y'all take care. We'll see you soon. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts. And Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
The world of business moves fast. Stay on top of it with the Fox Business Rundown every Monday and Friday. Listen to the Fox Business Rundown starting May 20th at foxbusinesspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.